Welcome to the Without a Roof program, where we expose and remedy poverty, the worst form of violence.
Look, my name is Brooke Blair and I'm 5 years old. I've got something to say to you, Theresa May. Yesterday night, I was out in the streets and I saw 100 million of homeless people. I saw one with floppy ears. I saw loads. You should be out there, Theresa May. You should be biscuits, hot chocolate sandwiches, building houses. Look, I'm only 5 years old. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm saving up money and there'll never be enough. You've got the pot of money. Spend some and help people. That's what you've got to do. Because we've had lots of wars in this country, and I do not like that, Theresa May. I'm very angry.
Gamero Mash, a.k.a. Without a Roof. Welcome to Without a Roof radio program. And I approve this five-year-old's message, plea for mercy from the British Prime Minister. And folks just joining, turning their dial, you are indeed listening to FM 90.1 KZFR. Chico listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or possibly even the volunteers. Got a good show. Most shows are good shows, so this is no exception. Really pleased to say, actually, this is going to be our last monthly show. We're going to be moving to a weekly on Indigenous Peoples Day, which is 10-12, next Wednesday, 5 to 5:30. Tune in. I'm even more pleased to say we're going to be using this one-hour block, first Thursday, 6 to 7, for Youth for Justice program, another Without a Roof produced program that's going to be all about youth and justice issues in our community. And the first show is actually going to be put on by folks that are doing a wonderful, wonderful job over the Peace and Justice Center on Wednesday mornings, Wednesday evenings. So look for that. That'll be coming up on November 3rd. All right, this is what we got going on tonight. We have a preview and promo of Lloyd Pendleton's visit. You might say who Lloyd Pendleton is. We're going to get to that very, very shortly. In Tuchico, in public speaking engagements, Monday night, October 10th. Joining us in the studio to do this introduction and to also sit in and interject on the main piece here is a 25-minute piece with Robert Marbit, a homeless consultant that visited on the invite of the Jesus Center several weeks ago. But joining us in the studio is Sienna Sunique. Sienna, I'm calling you a street angel that quite simply is making amazing things happen. So welcome to the show, Sienna.
Thank you.
And also joining us, I didn't clear this, you guys, this is how I worded it. I said Bob Trausch and his wife, Leslie Johnson. Leslie Johnson are joining us. They're founders and board members of Chico Housing Action Team. So welcome to the studio, guys. Guys
Thank
and girls.
You.
Thanks, Bill.
You know, I'd like to start because Leslie Bob comes right in. He opens the paper and you've got an article in the CNR, a guest comment about Lloyd Pendleton's visit. Maybe that's a good place to start.
Okay. Yeah. So our organization, CHAT, has been really looking for solutions to homelessness. And one of our group kept saying, we should bring Lloyd Pendleton. When you start researching homelessness, the first thing you read about, one of the first things is Utah. Utah is said to have had success in eliminating chronic homelessness. Chronic being the people that have been homeless for a year or more, have mental health issues, the people that really are difficult, you know, to help, more challenging to help. So Lloyd Pendleton took the job in Utah of being the director of the State Task Force on Homelessness and he was charged with nothing less than the solving the problem. So Utah came up with this ingenious idea that in order to help the homeless, we should give them homes. So an awful lot of the programs that are helping homeless people are helping them in a lot of different ways, but are not able to get them into housing. And that's really their first and foremost and primary need. So Lloyd Pendleton will be coming to Chico on Monday and Tuesday of next week to talk about that and how they did it. And I think we're all really interested to know how they made that happen and how they have been successful in Utah in getting people into housing.
So I know he's got some private meetings with different service providers and stuff, mostly on Tuesday. But actually, his main speaking engagement, I'm looking at the flyer here. I may get some input from you, Bob, on they're calling a solution to homelessness, reduce chronic homelessness by 90% in Utah, as Leslie Johnson mentioned. Lloyd Pendleton Admission is, we never mention price unless it's free.
It's free.
Monday, October 10th, 2016, 1 to 3 p.m. Bidwell Prez, 208 West 1st Street, Chico. Anything to add to that, Bob?
Well, you know, we would really like a lot of people to show up. Lloyd was actually in Reading several months ago, and about 500 people showed up. And so we're hoping to have something like that at Bidwell Prez as well. We really want the community to come in, listen to it, because that's the only way we really can engage the whole community in looking for the solutions. And Lloyd's going to be talking about Housing First, which is now actually a federal program. HUD has realized finally that to really help with homelessness, you house people, and then you bring them services. It is pretty impossible to bring services to people who are living on the street for so many reasons, transportation, more drug use, more alcohol use, missing appointments. All of the things that are attendant to living on the street are taken care of when someone has a home and security and a place to bathe, a place to cook, the place to keep their belongings, a place to sleep. Less sickness, less interaction with police. So we're looking for Lloyd to talk about that and how he reduced homelessness by 90%.
Awesome.
So I do want to mention one other thing.
Oh, go ahead.
While he's here, as you said, there are a number of speaking engagements and meetings, but he will also have a public event in Oroville. So on Tuesday at 5 o'clock, he'll be speaking in Oroville for the community there, because Oroville has shown a lot of interest in this issue as well.
Where is it going to be, do you know?
That'll be at the Southside Oroville Community Center, 5 o'clock till
7:30.
You know what? As we play Robert Marbitz, I'm going to actually kind of research and maybe give the full address, because I think it's important for our listeners in Oroville and maybe even down by Yuba City. It's not that far from Yuba City. Right, come on up and see Lloyd.
And that's quite interesting, because you and I did take a trip to Yuba City, where they have housing, small homes for people, and are actually making a difference, which we haven't been able to accomplish in Chico at this point. But it's a meet and greet in Oroville from 5 to 7:30. So, again, it's free. Just everyone who would like to come.
You know, I've been talking with Kat, who's kind of coordinated his visit, and then I think her direct quote was, "He's such a sweet, well-spoken man." That's what she said about him. So, Sienna, you have anything to add?
You know, I think that one of the most special things about this event is that it's really collaborative. So, the Greater Chico Homeless Task Force is a group that is composed of service providers, people experiencing homelessness, concerned citizens, and they're kind of presenting this event. And the event is also sponsored by the Housing Authority, Downtown Chico Business Association, CHAT, Youth for Change, 211, ACLU, Butte County Behavioral Health. I don't know if I said that already.
KZFR.
And North State Public Radio.
So we're all having kind of a stake in this, and we all are really in this learning mode of how do we solve this for our community. So the goal is to reach out and find out a little bit more about these solutions that are happening in other places and see what we can adapt for Chico and Butte County.
I just think the process of talking about it is extremely important. Now, transition to the next part of the program, and I'm really pleased. I had two separate interviews with Robert Marbitz, a homeless, nationally recognized homeless consultant, invited here by Lori Kutsuna, director at the Jesus Center. And I had an opportunity to do two separate interviews. And what we're going to do tonight, and the interviews were actually the outline I did for that, was looking at a nice piece that was written in the ER. So we walked kind of through the ER comments. He kind of did a debrief for the community. But what's going to be really, really fun is I'm going to play this pre-record with Robert Marbitz, recorded in our production studio here. And we're going to pause maybe 3-4 times and give our studio audience here, Robert Trausch, Leslie Johnson, and Sienna Sonique, you know, a chance to respond and give some of their insights into what they're hearing. And with no further ado, here on People Power 8, I'm going to shift my chair and I'm going to start off the Robert Marbitz interview here on People Power. This is Gamro Mash for the October Without a Roof radio program, and it's my real pleasure to have on the phone, dialing in. You from Texas right now, Robert? You back in Texas?
Yes, sir, back in Texas.
Yeah, I got Robert Marbitz here from Texas. Robert is a consultant on homelessness, and he's actually worked with hundreds of communities across America over the last, 30-some years you've been doing this. How long have you been doing your work, Robert? And give a quick introduction for yourself. That'd be awesome.
I'm 56, and I've been doing it since I was about 16. So what's that, about 40 years?
Specifically working on homeless issues since you were 16?
Yeah, I started out as a volunteer and was a continuous volunteer. I started out in a high school youth group, like many people do, or college youth group. And then when I went to, I was doing a postgraduate fellowship with the CORO, which is an urban affairs fellowship program, and got asked to be involved with the Olympic, 1984 Olympics in terms of how the homeless issue is affecting the downtown hotels. And then I later worked for Henry Cisneros as his chief of staff and did homeless issues for him, and then worked for President Bush, the father, and the White House and did homeless issues for him. And then later, when I got elected myself, I was given the portfolio of homeless on city council. And all that's before I really got serious about it in doing Haven for Hope.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's kind of interesting because I'm a homeless expert since 16 as a runaway in Boston, Massachusetts. I ran away from an abusive situation and walked all the way to Boston. It's kind of interesting for the locality of it, but I walk right by Ed Mayer, housing director of executive director of Housing Authority of Butte County. I walk by his whole alma mater, Phillips Academy, on my way to Boston. And I've actually done a lot of work myself, Robert, throughout Northern California since 2012, visiting communities, some of it experiencing homelessness in Northern California. So I'm really interested to share some, get some insights from you and kind of share some of my impressions as well. So no further ado, let's jump in here. Is there anything in that ER article that you feel needs clarification or, restating?
Very good to go. Some things I might emphasize a little more or talk about, but overall I thought it was a great article and really framed a lot of the issues that I see in the community. The one caveat I always give is when I come to a community, I only spent 48 hours there before I start to talk about my observations. And so at the beginning of the talk, I always say I normally get this about 85% right. Again, I was only there 2 days before I started sharing my thoughts, and so I probably missed some nuances, or I miss a certain player, don't hit everybody, but we tried to talk to as many groups, as many individuals as possible, and observe as much as I could in that time frame. But in doing that, there's some things I always miss, but that's just reality. Mm-hmm. But I think the big picture observations, like the one that really concerns me the most is the commingling of children with adult males. And I saw that everywhere. Every organization, every gathering, every feeding program I saw, even in the parks, that's just not a good thing to have happen. And that's one of those that no expert, regardless of sort of left-leaning, right-leaning, down the center, would say is a good thing. And so I think that one I got, pretty right on target, but then there might be other ones that I miss a little bit.
Well, let me talk about that one because it was such a fascinating thing. I did this Without a Roof. The first thing we did, Robert, was in Discovery Park, April 2012 in Sacramento. And I set up a media booth, and we did a picnic, and we had well over 100 folks come. It was promoted from Loaves and Fishes, et cetera, et cetera. But someone came over, and one of my volunteers, and said, hey, we have a homeless family that wants to talk to you. And I literally, at first, I didn't know who they meant because they were walking up, didn't fit the stereotypes. But it was a lesbian couple, and they had a 5-year-old and like a 3-year-old. And it was one of the most heartbreaking things I've seen, Robin. I've been doing this myself almost 5 years, in that you could see the physical trauma on these young people. Matter of fact, the 5-year-old was comforting her mom on camera. So it's been really near and dear to my heart, the whole homeless family issue above and beyond. But to me, Robert, it's more of an issue of, if you're homeless as a child with a mom and dad or with a family or unattached, you need to be in as normal a setting as possible. And living in a shelter or going to a homeless dinner or something like that is not anywhere near normalcy. That's kind of how I've looked at it. Is there anything you want to expand on that? Or
I couldn't agree more. You want it to be as normal as possible and not as institutionalized as possible. And you want to be as far from that. And as I explained to the agencies, it was beyond the legal liability, beyond the bad things that could happen with this, beyond your insurance rates going up, beyond any of that, what this does for the long-term mental typing, the developmental level of children, to see adult males in a food shelter line or a barracks or going to the bathroom or whatever, that imprints very badly forever. And that is a trauma that we can reduce, and through better management and just proactive thinking, you want to do everything you can to reduce that, because it hurts the childhood development of that child for the rest of that person's life. And so nothing good happens that way. So I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, I think I'd read somewhere that you're doing work in Placer County. That's where I raised a family, and I'm kind of familiar with their services too. But I think, as you had mentioned, that they have some churches there in Placer County that do you know, homeless feeds, homeless dinners, and they do separate hours. So, you know, I couldn't agree with more. I mean, to me, there was a little bit of stigmatization, though, and in some regards, I had some people push back, going, you know, is this a gender issue more than just a behavior issue? And that I don't want listeners to feel that, you know, just because you're homeless as a single male, that children shouldn't be around you. But from a development standpoint, you know, it's a really touchy subject. So
yeah, and it's touchy. And I get, you know, as you probably know more than anybody, the world of homeless gets people from the far left going, far right going, center. And I deal in reality. I don't deal in hypothetical land. And what we do know is that long term developmental with the child is not good in that setting.
All right, I'm going to turn it over to our studio audience of Leslie Johnson, Bob Trowles, and Sienna for some comments on that. Who wants to start?
Well, I didn't hear his talk in Chico, so I can't respond to all of it. But what I heard him talking about was normal daily functions of eating, going to the bathroom, interaction between males and children. And I don't understand why that is a trauma for anyone personally. I think that people who are homeless, what I've found is that they're very caring about all people. They understand the situation on the streets, and they do take care of each other. They know the stories on the street. So I'm not quite sure I agree with him. But again, I didn't hear his whole speech.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear Sienna.
Yeah, I had similar thoughts about that when he said he wants people to have, especially the children, to have as normal a life as possible and not have it seem institutional and then separate them, the men and the women, out like that. I didn't really like that because that doesn't seem normalizing. And if he's concerned about the children and what they're seeing and experiencing, I think we'd be a lot more concerned about the fact that they're experiencing living in cars or sleeping outside, not that they're seeing men getting helped by other people by being provided with meals. That doesn't seem like anything that would traumatize them. If anything, that would be comforting to know that there are people that care and that are helping all of us, you know, us that are homeless in that situation. So that just struck me as odd. When we have our overnight shelter, we definitely are careful about that, but that's different. I mean, when you're having 50 people sleeping on a church floor, that's a different thing. But for meals and everything, I don't see why people wouldn't mix. That seems dehumanizing in a way to separate them out like they're in jail or something.
And we have had young people come in with parents or father or mother and stay there, and we certainly watch and are careful because it is sleeping. What I would have liked to hear him say is that we would like to get them into housing as soon as possible, and I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Would be the answer for people who are forced, as Leslie said, to be living in the streets or living in a vehicle or under a bridge, young people and men. Let's do something about it rather than separating them. Let's find housing for them.
Yeah, this one I mentioned, that when I say trauma, the younger one, the 5-year-old, was really traumatized because how traumatized her mom was. And she actually, it was really heart-wrenching. I did not film anything outside the media booth but this one thing. She was play-acting, and I asked the moms, okay. She's like, when I get my own house, she's going to have a bedroom, and she's going to have a bedroom, and we're going to have Justin Bieber posters, and everyone's going to be happy. That's where we need to be. I don't think we need to be stigmatizing, you know, segregating the population for, you know, they just need to be in a healthy, happy, safe home.
So when I first heard him say that, I was really triggered by it, and I didn't get it, but I tried to step back a little bit and look And I feel like maybe he's just using some antiquated language. Really, if we turn the focus on preserving a family unit and creating a special space and time for families, I can get with that. I'm cool with that. But when we talk about dividing it into gender, I don't really relate to that. And he's not including the trans community or people that don't identify as male or female. So I think he's just a little bit off on that. But essentially, I do see the value in creating a safe, I don't know if safe is the right word, but creating a specific environment and time for families to be families. And then single adults can do it in a different time. I do see that value for sure.
Yeah, as you could hear, I mean, I saw that same thing. So, I said, it's a tough, nuanced issue, but I get my ears perk up anytime we're starting to dehumanize somebody, you know, with some of these.
Well, that's kind of what I heard was the dehumanization. Yeah. At least, and maybe that isn't what he intended, but that's what I was hearing. Yeah. He was saying basically that males who are homeless are dangerous.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what I was hearing, and I think that's not the case any more than a group of men in a theater when a young person is in there or in a family. Why is that any different? It actually isn't any different.
Beautiful story. A friend of mine, Adam, he was in the CNR a couple of years ago. Somebody, it wasn't even a homeless situation or not, but they jumped a lady and tried to kidnap her baby, and he was homeless on the street, and he's the one that jumped in and rescued the baby. So I don't know. There's plenty of stories like that. But let's get back to this interview, and I really appreciate all the insights here from our studio guests. But let's get back to Robert Marbit, who was visiting from Texas, and we got about 18 more minutes of Robert here on People Power Radio.
What you do know is there's a risk factor involved. There's no checking for background. There's no checking for a sexual predator and other such issues that do happen in some of our places, and we know that. And so I deal in the world of reality, and that it, what's happening now needs to change. And I think once everybody had sort of this conversation, everybody says, oh, gosh, that makes total sense. And I know at least two of the agencies were going to have meetings today, literally within 48 hours of me being there, to start talking about how do you separate? How do you deinstitutionalize that? And you can do it physically, or you can do it by time, space, you know, people getting services at different times, or a little of both. And ideally, you want to approximate the real world on the outside with the family as much as you can possibly, regardless of the parent mix type. It doesn't, to me, the parent type doesn't mix. I focus on the kiddos. Because they're the ultimate victims in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So transitioning to the next item, mental. I'm taking a deep breath. Mental health. I mean, it's a really serious issue, and I want listeners to know it's a really serious issue. But please don't be stereotyping. You know that people are only homeless because they're mentally ill. There's just a tremendous amount of folks that are homeless for one reason or another. But folks that are mentally ill that are out there, they're falling through the safety net, and it's really hard for them to get back up. Anything you'd like to add on that?
The mental health, behavioral health is one of the triggers. It's not the only trigger, but it is one of the triggers in homelessness. And you have some good programs in the area, right in your area, but you simply don't have the volume. You don't have the capacity to handle the need. And so it's not just what type of services you provide, it's having the right type of capacity, being right size. And something that didn't appear in the article that I spent some time talking about is when Ronald Reagan was both governor and president, he felt that should not be a role of government. And so he really pushed hard to reduce federal funding to mental health beds when he was president of the United States. He simply said, that's not something we should be in. And then in a very unusual move, the far left, and I don't mean the center left, I meant the far left, was literally, that was when One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out, and a lot of people misunderstood that and thought that was the whole system, rather than that one hospital in New York where everybody was sort of focused on. And so the far left joined with the far right. The far right didn't want to spend any money, and the far left said the money was being spent wrong. So they functionally joined together, and now, 30-some-odd years later, our mental health, federal mental health capacity, and it's hard to measure apple to apple because all the programs have changed, all the funding mechanism changed, but the closest you can get, the people I trust in the area, we had about 475,000 beds the day Ronald Reagan in. Our country's grown roughly 20%. Now we only have about 92,000 federally funded mental health and behavioral health beds. So that's a cut of 80%, even though our country's grown 20%, and that's a loss of funding. Locally, that reflects itself in how you deal with the 5150s, how you deal with long-term need, how you deal with outpatient care. And so all across the board, there's just not enough funding in mental health. And to be honest, you know, the first time I've heard it at all spoken of in about 20 years was in the early parts of the primaries and in early part of the election this year, in the presidential election. Several candidates started talking about that, and I thought, finally, after 20 years, people are starting to talk about it. Long way to go, but at least I think people are starting to talk about it.
Puts a lot of stress. I know personally, since I call it the work we do, street angels, but it puts a lot of pressure on private citizens like Sienna or Lisa Currier that are running around and call them champions, because in a rural setting, a lot of these different places are, you know, here, there, and yon. And, you know, if you're mentally ill, schizophrenic, and you've been mentally ill all your life, it's kind of hard to navigate the system. So there's just so much need and so little amount of resources. I really loved your point about the detox center. I had Jennifer Carvello, I don't know if you met with her, she was on about 3 months ago, and they had just opened up the very first quote-unquote detox facility here in Butte County, but we're just so desperately shy on those kind of resources, Robert.
And that's another area where...
I'm going to pause right there. You know, I'm really blessed. You know, I mentioned Sienna as a street angel, and Lisa Currier, who actually started her own little nonprofit, Triage, nonprofit to help people that are experiencing homelessness with mental illness. But this one's personal for me, Sienna, because I know Tyler, and one of my dearest friends here in Chico, that's her nephew. And, you know, I've helped him out. I've let him couch surf and stuff. But maybe you could just share a little bit. We're using a street named Ty, but a little bit about the process and how much better he's doing having someone champion for him.
Well, yeah. You know, the family was really, he was in jail for about 6 months, and then the family took him in. But, you know, after the 6 years of him being homeless after high school and in and out of jail and losing him for a while, everybody's not only emotionally tapped, but, you know, scared that they're going to lose him again. And what's interesting about it is that when you meet him, you know that there is some mental illness going on, perhaps some developmental delay, definitely not functioning at a level that you or I would be, but he has no diagnosis. And so he's been navigating this entire system and world by himself with no diagnosis, no medication, just really, really, really underserved there. Another thing, we took him to get an eye exam, and it turns out he's legally blind and been walking around without glasses for years. So he's been in and out of jail, court dates, and everything, not being able to see. So it's really interesting to see just how deep it goes when somebody is underserved. And the processes to get them through this system are hard. You know, I mean, it is, you got to get to intake at Monday morning or Tuesday afternoon. And if you're not there, you got to wait a whole nother week. Now, 5 days on the street is intense. A lot can happen. A person can erode very quickly in 5 days on the street. So what you may have only needed to solve on that Monday could be completely different by the next Monday. So you got to get them in there. And then it's 2 weeks to your first appointment. And then it's 2 weeks until, you know, could be 3 to 5 weeks till you get medication. So, you know, people need advocates. People need groups of people to go in and help with all of these services. And otherwise, you just don't make those appointments and you don't get the help you need.
You know, one thing I want to add to just help clarify and help people educate on the issue is one of the hardest things about it, I won't mention any names, but there was somebody that disparaged him going, yeah, maybe he'd do better if he's off of drugs. But my dear friend had literally told me before he told me that. So I pushed back on him. He said, it's so horrific because he acts like he's on drugs if he's not on drugs. He's has severe mental illness. So a lot of people tend to just push him aside going, it's his problem because he's on drugs. And I mean, that's just not something we should be doing. And Ty is only like 23, 24. What would you guys add?
Well, you know, for me, two things. One, we have spent a lot of money. There is a lot of money in the federal system for people who are mentally ill, and they do have beds. Unfortunately, those beds are in jails and prisons and not in facilities where they're getting help.
Yeah.
So it's how we want to spend that money. We can put them into a place like the PUF and possibly get some help. Or we can put them in jail where it's very, very expensive to be. So it's us trying to change how that federal funding comes down the pipes and where that federal funding goes. Because after Reagan did cut all that funding, there was a dramatic increase in funding for jails to or prisons to house people. I had someone in my family who had mental illness, and the PUF has 17 or 16 beds. I mean, I was told that in 1982 in the county there were over 200 beds. Now we have 16 beds available. So we know what happens to them. We house the homeless in prisons. And someone said to me about a family member, well, at least they're safe in jail. And to me, it was so outrageous that somebody would say something like that, because what they're saying is that we have no understanding or education about what it is to be mentally ill, and that is something else that we need in our society, is an understanding of the illness and how to cope with it and why we should be spending money on it rather than making these people be prisoners and felons and whatever.
I've been to several presentations by Andy Duke as the head of the Butte County Jail, and a couple of them he mentioned, you know, obviously not exact terms, you know, a lot of these people are better off in jail than they were living on the streets. It's like, that is such a horrific thing, you know. It might be in some essence true. I mean, he's looking at, hey, they're getting dental. Hey, they got three hots in a cot. Hey, look at this. But that's not where we want to go as a nation, thinking that our homeless problem is solved or people are safer when they're in jail, you know.
Yeah, and I was talking to someone who was schizophrenic and was in jail, and they related the stories as to what happened to them from other prisoners in that jail, the harassment they got from the guards, from the other prisoners, the beatings, the things that occurred, and it's outrageous. And that's how we spend our money versus spending money taking care of them and helping them to deal with the illnesses that they have. And they can be dealt with and it can be helped.
All right, well, listeners just joining, this is Guillermo Mash for the Without a Roof radio program, and we're listening to an interview by Robert Marbit that we pre-recorded last week. Robert came through Chico a week or so ago, and we did this recording, and we've got Leslie Johnson, Bob Trausch, and Sienna Sonik. Am I saying that last name right? Is that close
Sinoki.
Enough? Sonoki. Thank you for me. Sonoki.
It's okay.
Sonoki. But anyway, we're going to get back to the interview with Robert right now on People Power Radio.
It's intermingled, but not... For some people, it's a co-presenting issue. For other people, it's just a completely different issue. And I think there's a tendency on the right wing in particular to really focus on substance abuse and drug use and such. And I've been around this a long, long time, and I've seen virtually no what I call recreational drug use. You simply can't afford it if you're on the street. But I have seen a lot of self-medicating, substance abuse or misuse. As much as the middle class uses Ambien to go to sleep, if you live out on the street, and I've probably lived on the street 120 days of my life working with different groups, I generally spend 2 or 3 days on the street, at least sometimes longer, to learn the community, learn the flow and such. And if your temperature outside drops 30 or 40 degrees in a night, you have insects biting you, you might have some lizards or some sort of, you know, bugs or beetles going, you have police hassling you, at the beginning of the month when you have money in your pocket, because you can't, nobody will bank you, so you don't have a bank, so when you get a check, you cash it, and all you have in the pocket, and some street gangs start to roll you for the money, how in the world would you get sleep? If anybody else would have said, you're going to put you outside and do that, you're going to have to take Ambien to go to sleep. And so a lot of the substance abuse is misunderstood as simply being able to try to go to sleep at night and how hard it is to sleep at night. And then you add to that dehydration, which occurs partly because you don't have enough fluids on the street and partly because they don't want to be arrested or get a ticket or be hassled by the police for urinating in public. And so you have chronic dehydration on top of sleep deprivation. So whatever you got going, everything's exacerbated. Everything is made worse for lack of good sleep and lack of improper hydration, let alone nutrition and everything else along the line.
Because shout out to Bobby Walden, runs the HUD-BASH program here, Robert. But he'd said to me after I got housed through HUD-BASH, kind of, and said, you know, at least I didn't have, you know, any mental illness issues. And he stopped me. He's an MSW. He said, no, I want you to know here right now, Mash, that if you're homeless, chronic homeless, you've been out there 6, 8, 10 months. If you're homeless, you're experiencing mental anguish. You're in a mental health issue, period. And, you know, really, really resonated with me 2 years ago, but I see that everywhere I go. I mean, it is such a traumatic experience.
And that is so right, because you have the trauma of the original trigger, whatever your original trigger was, but then you have the trauma of living on the street, and so you sort of get this double trauma going, and in some issues, you know, like the new emerging one, military sexual trauma, and I had worked real hard to try to get the VA and the feds and DOD to realize you got a real problem there. And unfortunately, with the federal government, unless you codify it or give it a name, you don't get it. You don't get help. And so they finally have come out this year with military sexual trauma. And for the ladies that are having that, they sort of have the mix of post-traumatic stress syndrome plus basically domestic violence combined in one. And so in many cases, people have a tertiary trauma level that if we don't deal with, things will be worse later.
I appreciate it.
I'm going to stop right there. And I'm actually got a really quick comment just to help listeners on 90.1 FM, People Power Radio. You got to be careful with blanket statements. I hear a lot of blanket statements in here, and I know it's well-intended, but the comment that Robert made was really off mark, saying there's no such thing as recreational drug use. They just can't afford it. It's sending the message to anyone doing drugs as a drug addict. And actually, if you look at populations, segments like homeless youth, there's a tremendous amount of recreational drug use. But anytime, I don't want to even split hairs on this one or dig in because I want to give time to the studio audience. Anytime you hear blanket statements, do a timeout signal and dig in, because there's no such thing as a blanket statement when it comes to a fellow human being.
Yeah, one of the things when with Chat that we found working with people that are homeless, because Chat does the Safe Space Winter Shelter program, there's just exactly what you said. There's such a range of different kinds of people, different kinds of issues and problems and experiences and backgrounds. You could never group them all together. But the one thing that we really saw consistently was a lot of health issues of all kinds. And that was one of the most surprising things for me, is that when people would come in, and we're just giving them a floor and a mat to sleep on and a dinner. That was it, just for the night. They have to leave first thing in the morning with a cup of coffee. But so many of them needed, really had health needs. I mean, a lot of them were older, 50, 60, even in their 70s, a lot were disabled or had a chronic serious health conditions. It's terrible. They should be, some of them should be in the hospital, you know, or should definitely be getting care. And another thing I wanted to mention that I just found out about today was there used to be a plan to have a house right outside Enloe where people that were being released from the hospital after surgery or some kind of serious health problem would have a place to stay for up to a month. And we should really get something like that going again, because, you know, even through a collaboration with a lot of different agencies, because just yesterday I saw somebody laying on the sidewalk by the plaza in a hospital gown, just laying on the sidewalk trying to sleep. Obviously, just came out of the hospital. It's so awful.
And last year we had people brought from the hospital in gowns to sleep, and it literally dropped off at Safe Space. It was unbelievable.
One had a catheter.
And one had a catheter, right, that was brought to us to, because they were thrown out of the hospital, and the catheter still in and brought to us. It's unbelievable. Another thing that we had this last year in particular were a lot of mental illness in our community at night that we had to deal with. So there was lots of time spent dealing with those kinds of issues. Right. Unfortunately, we had people who were willing to do that.
One thing I'll add before I jump over to Sianna trying to manage the minutes here is Guitar Clem. I've done a lot of work with him. He's housed through HUD-VASH, and I swear to God, I got my left hand raised. A month later, he looked 10 years younger. Literally 10 years younger. Only thing that changed for him is he was housed. He was still drinking. He's an alcoholic. He was housed. He looked 10 years younger. Sianna?
You know, I just wanted to mention that, you know, just like you were talking about Enloe, about or being at the hospital and being dropped off in a gown, and, you know, and we talk about the services at behavioral health being so hard to actually get. I have learned in the year that I've been doing this that everybody is really, really trying hard and trying hard in their own way to figure it out. And I think that's what's so incredible about this kind of new way we're taking, where we're bringing Marbot here, we're bringing Lloyd Pendleton here, and organizations that all have different vantage points and different stakes, different funding sources, and different, you know, just angles of this whole conversation are coming together to try to find something that works for all of us, because it's real easy to get divisive. But I think that our community is really, really collaborative.
Yeah. Thank you for adding that, because I've worked, it's been a few years, but I did a lot of work in Nenlo with about three or four different people. And I work with some of the social workers trying to find them a place. And it's hard for these social workers, man. It's a lot. It's hard on them because they don't want to discharge these people. You could see it in their face.
Yeah. But I'm going to get we see that as well. I mean, we have some houses. Chat has some houses where we've master leased. And we've had incredible success. And it's so exciting to see the success. And it's so exciting to see people forming families and being really happy about being inside and starting to get on social services. And so, you know, what we need to do is change the hearts and minds of some of our civic leaders, our community leaders, because as Sienna said, we have all of these incredible service organizations that are doing, all right, I'll let you go.
Thanks, man. Hey, I give you a plug because I love Bob Judge, but we're going to do a whole program, man. Yeah. I'm going weekly for a half hour. We're going to do one or two shows coming up in the next month or two. So back to Robert Marbot here on People Powered Radio.
That issue, because I actually have talked a lot about domestic violence, you know, in front of audiences, but I was just on CSU campus here talking about that very issue at a Veterans Voices. I was a Veteran Voice presenter last month, and I talked a lot about sexual assault and PTSD. So thank you so much for that work, Robert. I'm gonna come down here to, they paraphrase it as Tough Talks, and the way they had worded it, Robert, was programs that provide food to the hungry are common and well-meaning, yet the community is not having enough conversations about whether you are enabling. So maybe you could explain that sentence, particularly the use of enabling and what that implies.
What I believe is if you're an agency, and this is really addressed toward agencies and organizations and initiatives, is that you got to have your brain going and you got to have your heart going. And you got to have both going at the same time. And when you provide help, not all help is good. Likewise, not all help is bad. And so you got to really figure out what type of help engages person into recovery. My measurement, my number one measurement, is how many people graduate from the street forever. I don't measure how many sleeping bags get taken out, how many plates of food get served, how many tents get handed out. I measure things like, do we drop the number of people in jail? Because I just think criminalization is a waste of time, waste of money, and it doesn't help the individual. I measure how many people are no longer going to the emergency room. I measure how many people graduate permanently from the street. I measure how many people get permanent market rate housing. And so when you focus on that, rather than some intermediate steps or some really output step, you really have to start to say, what are we doing as an organization engaging people into long-term recovery, or are you sustaining a person and not getting recovery, not moving toward recovery? And I think you got to have very honest conversations about it. And I'm not saying there's a perfect answer or it's that black and white, but you want to be healthy about it, and you're healthy by having a conversation. Is what we're doing really helping a person work toward graduation?
I'm really glad for that clarification. I'm actually going to land on this for just a little bit longer, because it's kind of near and dear to my heart. I've done a lot of, you know, outreach, you know, on the streets to homeless folks, giving them food here, hither and yon. And it was actually Ed Mayer again about 3 years ago. I mentioned Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired. Did a lot of research on it 3 years ago, and I think it's a very sound approach looking at if someone's hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, they are experiencing anguish, and either of those four things needs to be eliminated. So a lot of the work I do and a lot of the, you know, quote-unquote private citizens that aren't attached to a nonprofit is related to trying to alleviate those symptoms. So when we read this sentence, I want to make sure when I read that sentence, you're more applying it to service agencies in town like the Torres Shelter and the Jesus Center versus someone giving out a peanut butter sandwich on the street.
Well, it can be also for the individual, but my real target in the context of that forum was how do agencies address it. But I will also flip it and say it can be individuals too. But and I was working in a place in St. Petersburg, Florida, at a park That's a famous park down there in the West Tampa area. And it struck me that the first day I got there to help out, there were 7 meals fed in that park during the day. Not one of them was healthy. Not one of them was nutritious. Some of them were actually very non-nutritious. Some were in the middle of the road. Some were just like donuts. And when you're feeding in a park 6, 7, 8 times a day, very unhealthy food, that's not moving the ball. That's not helping a person toward graduation. We want to think about nutrition. We want to think about hydration. We want to think about sleep and sleep deprivation. Because if you mess up those three, whatever you have going, whether it's a substance issue, whether it's mental health, the behavioral health, post-traumatic stress, acute stress, domestic violence, lack of nutrition, lack of hydration, lack of sleep makes everything worse. And so I like to think of it as a very holistic system. And I don't think you ever get to perfect. I think some very good people on both sides might have slight disagreements. But I do think you should always be honest about what we're doing and ask the question, are we enabling or are we engaging? Are we moving a person toward recovery or are we keeping a person toward recovery?
What do you think of Food Not Bombs? They serve a lot of nutritious meals across the country.
Yeah, some do. And what I've encouraged that group, because in some cities I've worked in and around them, I always encourage any food programs to be aligned with programs that deal with the root cause of the homeless, the mental health, the behavioral health, the post-traumatic stress, the domestic violence. And if you align the feeding program with the behavioral health, the mental health, and other, you get really good results. When you disalign those and everybody's out working independently, you don't get as good a success rate as you can. I'm all about trying to get as many graduates as I can.
We'll move on for that one, but we'll just have some level of, because we don't have time. I think if we would talk more on this, we might come up with more agreement, but I don't.
Yeah, I'm actually going to pause there to turn it over to our studio guest here on that particular topic. Who wants to go first? Looks like you, Bob.
Go ahead.
About food?
Yeah, anything you just heard. Or enabling?
Enabling.
Well, you know, I guess there's something to be said for drawing that distinction. However, I also think that what my experience with working with homeless people has been through Safe Space, and what I feel is that if they really feel the love coming through, that you're there because you care about them, then maybe even sometimes little things mean a lot. And I just saw somebody in front of Rite Aid, young girl, barefoot, with that day that it poured rain a few days ago. And I'm sure she was high. She was bouncing around. And I guess I was enabling her because I went in Rite Aid and bought her some shoes and socks. And she hugged me, you know. She knew I cared. And I encouraged her to go to the tourist shelter. And she said, oh, I was there once a long time ago. And I said, try it. You know, go try it again. Try to get in there, and they're more flexible now about letting you in, even if you're using, and then, you know, you'll have to quit. But
right.
And you never know when you're going to make a difference. About 4 years ago, I was on the street downtown on Second Avenue, Second Street, and I happened to just have money in my pocket, a considerable amount of money. I had just been paid, and I saw someone who was homeless, a woman who was homeless, who I knew. I was told I'd been selling herself for money, and I gave her some money. I just gave her quite a bit of money, and I just walked on. A year later, I saw her again in the street, and she started walking towards me, and I thought, she remembers me, she wants money. And I admit, I was doing this, walking, trying to avoid her, thinking, oh my gosh. She said, stop, I want to thank you. You gave me money, and you had no expectations. So you never know what's going to happen or what can change someone's life.
That's a great story, Bob. Thank you so much for that. Sianna?
You know, I think that when we look at, like, enabling versus engaging, you know, I don't look at that as, like, on a personal one-to-one level. I mean, if somebody's hungry and we're giving them food, or if you're providing somebody shoes, I personally don't see that as enabling any situation. What we need to look at is our network of services, and I don't even know if enabling is the right word, is our network of services actually, you know, And our network of housing, is it actually promoting this to keep happening in our community where people don't stay housed? And so when we need to look at our network of services and look at our housing stock, I mean, we have less than 2% vacancy rate in this community. So if we we would love to see people graduate into housing, but the housing does not exist in this
town.
Yeah,
it's functionally zero.
You know, yeah. I mean, we need to look at it from a lot of different angles from the top level of services. And on a personal level, I think that it is that love and compassion that brings hope into people's lives, so that maybe I do go to the DMV and get the strength to go get my ID, or get the strength to go get my EBT card or Social Security or whatever it is that will help me progress.
Or start going to AA or whatever it happens to be. And it is interesting. I didn't hear his speech, but I never heard him actually talk about housing people. Housing first. I don't know if that'll be in the second
segment that I'm going to air next week. So I'm going to do a segment that's coming up on the very first Without a Roof radio program weekly. I'm going to have half of it for Lloyd and half of it for Richard Marbit. I'm going to finish up this interview and have a few more minutes with our wonderful studio guests here on People Powered Radio. Fine, you know, giving people food, enabling. But what I would add, though, Rob, because I agree with a lot that you're saying, I don't just give people food. I engage them. I'll go down and sit with them. Hey, so what's going on? I heard you lost your house. I mean, this is kind of the street outward stuff that you're talking about. And I've been to places, Robert, that serve food, and you're like, oh, my God, I don't ever want to go there again. They look like I was in prison. So I think there's a lot around that we could maybe do a separate interview.
Agreed. But let me give you one extreme one. I was working in a city, absolute real-life city in Florida, and a motorcycle group, a little motorcycle club, every Wednesday night would go buy 300 hamburgers at McDonald's, and McDonald's gave them a cheap rate. And they would drive along in the two pairs of two, sort of like a group of pot of four. They would hit each intersection, and they would do this all over town. And they literally threw hamburgers out like you were seeing, you know, something being thrown out at Mardi Gras. And I thought it was one of the most disrespectful, undignified thing that I've ever seen. And when you're just throwing food off of a motorcycle, if that's not enabling, I don't know what it is. And it's certainly not engaging. It's not engaging a person in recovery. It looked more like this horrible exhibit at a zoo. And that's why I think when you do it with other programs or engagement as you described it, where you're really developing the relationship and you're working toward a recovery, I'm all in for that. But a lot of programs simply aren't that. And you go out on the street, you see some programs, and you just scratch your head and you go, oh my gosh. You know, so, and I know that may be a different conversation for a different time.
Maybe we'll make this part one. Part one of two.
There you go.
Part one of two, the sequel to come. The next one's going to be panhandling with Robert Marbit. Any closing comments, Robert, before I let your family head off to the first presidential debate?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say is that, you know, there's always a tendency when we do these sorts of interviews to sort of focus on the gaps, the 5150, the lack of housing, and what have you. But I got to say, your community of Chico is one of the nicest communities of people who really like each other. If you look at my comments I make in other cities, I'll be very honest and very vocal about the problems. I have never seen a community who so sincerely, on a whole, wants to work with each other to do the right thing. People may have honest disagreements on how to do it, but there's a real sincerity in when I've never seen a situation where one agency got into financial trouble and all the other agencies gathered around to help them and say, we need to support them and prop them up. I've never seen that before. Virtually every other place I've seen is another agency might kick the chair out of them while they're struggling. And to see agencies in the community line up to help that one agency that was struggling, that is just so unusual. And it also, you know, rings to how what a special community Chico is.
I'll lead with that on part two. I kind of like this. We'll schedule some time when I get back from Florida, man.
Would love to. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, that's the ending of the first Robert Marbit interview. You can hear his another portion of the interview next this coming Wednesday, and we're going to have him on talking about housing. So everyone's got a minute. A one-minute wrap-up, starting with Leslie. Thank you, Leslie.
The solution to homelessness is housing, and CHAT is one organization. We're just one. But one of the things that we've been doing is renting houses and then subletting rooms to formerly homeless people. And if you can help us with that, then we will be successful in really reducing the problem of homelessness or even ending that problem, because housing comes first. So if you're a landlord, if you have a house and you're willing to rent it, we will rent it from you and put in subtenants, just like the students do, where they rent a room. We rent a room to various homeless people because oftentimes they can't afford a room. They have some income. And then we'll be responsible for the rent and taking care of the place. So get in touch with us if that's awesome. Of interest.
I just want to make sure I slip in that Solution to Homelessness, Lloyd Pendleton, this coming Monday, 1 to 3 p.m. at Bidwell Presbyterian, downtown Chico. Sienna, what do you got?
I would like to just encourage people to please, please, please get involved.
Yes.
You know, a year ago, I was the type of person that worked 40 hours a week, and my heart hurt when I saw people in need, but I didn't know how to help. And now I do it all the time, and it's really changed my life personally. But also, you know, these are our neighbors. This is our community, and you've got a small percentage of people trying to tackle this problem when you look at the numbers in our community. And I know people care. You know, you see it on Chico Stolen Bike. You see it when people are talking about issues downtown. People are really, really care about this issue, and I would encourage people to get involved. Volunteer at Safe Space if you work in the day. Come to the Greater Chico Homeless Task Force meetings if you have days off. Please, please, please come to A Solution to Homelessness with Lloyd Pendleton on Monday. We are going to have a reinvention of how we approach homelessness in this town right now. It's happening right now. So I would say now get involved. Please do.
That's my breadbasket. Get involved. Bob Trouse, that's the lead-in for getting involved.
You know, that the people in Chico really do care. There's an amazing number of organizations and people that are coming together. And, you know, I hope a lot of people come out on Monday from 1 to 3 at the Presbyterian Church, because it is World Homeless Day, and it's the right day to come out and to learn more about how we can work together to make those changes. Leslie was talking about Chad and our houses. We've had such amazing success. We had one person who came in with drug and alcohol problems, has now moved on to Seattle. Then we got stable. We had two other people who came in with drug and alcohol problems. We let them come in wet into our houses, and then we work with them. They now have jobs. They're saving money. It's so exciting to see those changes, and that one ingredient was housing. That one ingredient. And awesome. So, as Leslie said, get involved.
Get involved. Said, have discussions like involved. This. I love doing these panels because actually physically, you know, we're discussing an issue that's very near and dear to my heart, but it is 7 o'clock straight up. Time for Beatle Nation. We're going to lead you in with a, I don't even know what song it is. They said play number one, and I am going to play number one here on People Powered Radio. But before that, I just really want to thank all of our studio guests and Richard Marbit for taking time out of his own personal life to do the pre-recorded interview here on People Powered Radio.